This episode is brought to you through the support of our patrons over at patreon.com. You can go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast to learn how you can support your favorite show for as little as $1 a month. We truly can't overstate how important these donations are and how they truly keep the lights on month to month. Thank you so much to everyone who has donated. If you're interested in learning about other exclusive bonus content, things like getting the uncut version of the show early, as well as periodic bonus episodes released through that specific exclusive Patreon feed. Again, you can go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast. On with the show.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone Podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm going to die.
Oh, no.
No, I'm not. I'm Jason Moisoso, but I am sitting here excited to hear more about UFOs.
And you're feeling better.
I am feeling
better. You're feeling better from last week.
The opposite of death. I've become reborn.
Okay. This is good.
I can breathe through my nose now is the thing.
You know what's...
I've forgotten what that's like.
I know, right? So this is good. We've kind of transitioned, as far as Jason is concerned, we've transitioned from like a nuts and bolts podcast into something more metaphysical, something more transcendental, wherein Jason is reborn. So that is good.
I am the Phoenix.
Okay. So good deal. We are just going to jump right back into it here. This is now, well, actually, let me start this with a quote by my good friend Rob Christofferson.
Rob.
So, as you will remember, hopefully, from the last episode you listened to, we're talking about UFOs in the government, specifically the government's experiences with UFOs, their UFO programs.
Let's be honest, it's the U.S. government.
Right, the United States government, yes.
We're international.
We are, I guess that's true. We are,
we are
a worldwide phenomena, not alone podcast. So yes, we essentially are doing this series on the government's encounters with UFOs, the United States government's encounters with UFOs, their official programs and stuff like that. And I had thought that we could do this in two episodes.
My sweet summer child, yeah. How you're wrong.
Yeah, and according to Rob, he says, quote, "I think you're a fool for thinking you can do it in two episodes, but not a fool for doing it." So that's good. That made me feel – it actually did help me. It's fine that I'm a fool, but – so what I'm trying to say here, I'd promised you people a two-parter, but you have a three-parter on your hands. And the reason I know you have a three-parter – is because our typical word count for an episode is somewhere around 5,000 to 6,000 words. The word count for this episode alone is 10,000 words, and I'm not even done with it. So we're going to cut that. We're going to split it and bring you part two next week. So more UFOs.
I don't think we can handle it all.
I don't think we could either. I think I'd start crying at a certain point.
This is a much bigger journey than I was signed up for.
I know, me too. And I'm the one who signed you up for it.
I know.
That was like a terrible metaphor about, I don't know. So yes, strap in, enjoy. We are going to be looking now, starting part two of our hopefully three-part series.
Oh dear.
On the United States government's interaction with unidentified flying objects.
So as a quick recap, last week we covered, let's see, what was it? It was Sign. And then we had Grudge. And then now it's the start of Blue Book,
the correct? Beginning of Project Blue Book.
All right.
Yes.
So, and then now we have found essentially our star of the show.
Yes. Yes. So beyond the fact that everything we're talking about is sanctioned, at this point sponsored by the government, there's only one other thing that really ties it all together besides the UFOs and the government, and that is one man who saw each individual project through from beginning to finish, and that man is one of the titans of ufology and an invisible.
He's invisible!
He's invisible!
Invincible! Oh, God. What were you going for?
Individual.
that's totally different.
Yep. He is an individual who changed the course of the unknown for all history, not just with the paranormal, but also for mainstream science. Now, this individual is Dr. J. Allen Hynek. And Hynek was an explorer. He was a curious individual who was never satisfied with the answers of I don't know or that's the way it is. And I wrote here, and I like this line, so I'm going to say this line. He chased knowledge the same way other men chased wealth, which is to say he was very smart, but not very wealthy, which is fine. That happens a lot.
Thank you for your in-depth deciphering of that that quote.
You're welcome. The quote that I made.
Oh, that you made that quote.
I made the quote, and then I explained it to you.
Gotcha. Now,
this, all right. In addition to his important, it's one of those early recording sessions, if you can't tell. In addition to his extremely important contributions to ufology, he is also the man who discovered why stars twinkle, and he was one of the first people who said, hey.
Why do they twinkle, Sam?
I don't know, dude. I'm not a freaking astrologer or astronomer.
So he figured it out, but you didn't.
He figured it out, but I didn't figure it out.
To know what it is. Is it from like solar flares and stuff?
I don't think so, no.
Oh.
Okay, I don't know.
Fine. Whatever.
It has something to do with
our twinkle because they do.
How our eyes perceive light or something.
That makes sense.
He also was one of the first people to say, hey, let's take all these telescopes here and put them up there in the space-time.
Okay, Patrick.
Wait, Patrick who?
Let's take Bikini Bottom and move it over there. Okay.
That is not the reference. It's not the reference I was going for. That may be your own personal
reference. Let's take
all the
telescopes and put them up there.
Up there. So he was one of the first people who, you know, with like the Hubble telescope, stuff like that, recommended that that's what we do, that we could, that it was entirely possible and that there was no reason we couldn't. And we're going to start out talking about this man. So Dr. J. Allen Hynek was born Joseph Allen Hynek, and he was born into our world on the 1st of May 1910 as Halley's Comet moved further and further away from our sun. Now, he was born to Joseph Allen Hynek and Bertha Hynek, both of Czech origin. His mother had been born in the United States, a child of Czech immigrants, and his father was an immigrant himself. Now, growing up, his father and his grandfather owned a business together, which was a cigar manufacturing and sales operation.
Sounds magnificent.
Right? His home was always filled with cigar smoke and the smell of tobacco, which is someone who has not had a cigarette for 110 days.
Good job, dude.
Thank you. I'd like to smell that, please.
See, like, I don't even like smoking cigars. I don't like the smell of tobacco.
Right.
Just like holding a cigar, though.
You feel good.
You know,
you
just
good.
Like the texture is like, a cigar.
Weighty. Now, Hynek had a fairly happy childhood, but his world would change forever when he contracted scarlet fever at the age of 7. He was quarantined and ostracized from his friends in the outside world, and as he was, Hynek began reading anything and everything that he could get his hands on. If he couldn't read it, his mother would read it for him. And in what she described as a moment of desperation, as her son devoured every single book that they owned and everyone that they could borrow from friends and family.
I'm literally picturing him just
eating books. I know, right?
Just mouth open.
That it's a great image because that's essentially what it is.
That's how you defeat scarlet fever. Is that yeah?
You kill it with knowledge.
You drown it with paper.
With books. I like it. She essentially grabbed a astronomy textbook from a high school class. And she said, okay, we're just going to read this. And so she read the entire textbook to him cover to cover. She wasn't really grabbing on anything, but he was just
enthralled by it.
He was enthralled by it. And he showed, even at that age of 7, he showed comprehension of these ideas. Now, it was from that moment on that he began to speak of nothing else other than being a scientist when he grew up. And although he had quite the penchant for writing as well, he was wowing his instructors and classmates from around the age of 10. Even his short fiction would point back to him being a scientist and being an explorer in that realm. Essentially, like, there was this one time when he was writing, I think it was like a murder mystery or a detective kind of case story, and he described the feeling that the detective had when he solved the case as the same one that a scientist would have when he made a great scientific breakthrough. He really wanted to be a scientist. Who thinks like that?
Not me.
Who's like, oh, this great feeling, this must be what scientists feel like. Science is beautiful. He was a very big nerd.
Let's just phrase it like that.
Let's just call it out.
Let's be honest here.
But he was also, he also had an interest in some of the less concrete aspects of the universe as well. Hynek was also extremely interested in the occult, as well as the concept of hidden knowledge or secret knowledge, which goes hand in hand with it. Now, it's unfortunate and tragically easy to kind of understand why, at least in part, this may have been the case. Hynek's father passed away when he was only 12 years old. It would be the trauma of his father's death at such a young age that would most likely push him in this direction. But in any case, he began studying things that stood in stark contrast to his love of analytical science and observational data. Now, as a teenager, he had saved $100 of his own money. And that is, in his money, in those days, that's $1,300. Right?
But what did he spend it on, Sam?
He spent it on, he would later say to Jacques Vallée, all of my friends were just surprised I didn't buy a motorcycle like they did. He would spend it on a book titled, and this is all a quote.
Oh, yeah.
An encyclopedic outline of Masonic, Hermetic, Kabbalistic, and Rosicrucian symbolical philosophy being an interpretation of the secret teachings concealed within the rituals, allegories, and mysteries of all ages.
Good job there.
Yeah.
That is a title.
It is it's a titanic title of a text.
You know what I like about that title?
Hmm.
Tells me exactly what I'm getting.
Just like Jerry Seinfeld.
Exactly.
Yes. It is. It's nowadays, or not nowadays, but it was also referred to, I think, as simply the mysteries of all ages, because people obviously didn't want to say that.
Why didn't you just start with that?
Well, it's a good name, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was written by a mystic by the name of Manly P. Hall. Like I said, it was $1,300 in those days. I was only able to find one copy of it online, and it was retailing for $1,600. Mm-hmm. So
it's a pretty penny. That's more than my motorcycle.
If you want to buy this for us, please do. Send it to me. Alternatively, I think I found a free PDF version of it.
There we go.
And while I do enjoy having the physical media as well as the digital. Yep. Wow, it's a pirating a mystical text by a man who is long dead. I feel like piracy laws don't apply when you're talking about like occult magical textbooks. See,
when you just described it like that, I imagined literally like Raiders of the Lost Ark, the skeleton with webs all over it, just holding a PDF file.
Not even a flash drive or a floppy, but like he's holding a file.
Yeah, you look at it, it says what the file is. .pdf.
.pdf, yes.
Yeah, it's the whole name of the book.
Yes, .pdf. I love it. But yes, if you send us this book, we'll send you our undying love. That's a pretty... Well, I will actually owe you a life debt.
Sam.
Jason will be in your service forever. So that's a pretty good deal.
It's a bad service. Just smart remarks most of the time.
Just being sassy. Now, Hynek's high school career marked him as brilliant, and when the time came for him to pursue his childhood dream, he did decide to go with a degree in astronomy, as you might expect, from the University of Chicago. Now, he graduated...
Shake it up.
He graduated from there in 1931 with his bachelor's and followed that up with a doctorate in astrophysics in 1935.
So, at this point in time, you can kind of say, like, he's the... Why am I drawing blank? He's got, like, three names.
Neil deGrasse Tyson?
Yes.
He's like not the Neil deGrasse Tyson. Just because somebody has...
He's not the Neil deGrasse Tyson of his life?
Just because somebody has a degree in astrophysics does not make them the Neil deGrasse Tyson of something. What the heck, Jason?
But as we find out later on, like he does get involved.
I suppose you could say he's the Neil deGrasse Tyson of UFOs, which
sure.
is not a bad
I'm fine with
statement.
That.
Okay. I like it. He wasn't. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, what astrophysics person do we have that became famous around his time period?
Carl Sagan.
Oh.
And he and Sagan were...
I know nothing about astrophysics.
I don't either. But I do know that I've watched Cosmos about 32 times. Did you ever see that?
No.
You didn't see that?
I should have.
I have it on DVD, and I think it's on Netflix. You should watch it. It's
probably,
amazing.
It should be on Netflix.
It's amazing. Netflix.
Okay.
Watch that.
I'll check it out.
Okay. Anyway.
Is Neil deGrasse Tyson in it?
Yeah, it's hosted
then, yeah,
by Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Why haven't I watched it yet?
Right. That's what I'm saying. So, anyway... Back to this. Right after he graduated from 1936 to 1941, he worked as a teacher, an instructor, and an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at Ohio State University. But then the war came. And when it did, Hynek did his part in his own way. He worked as a civilian scientist at John Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory.
That sounds awesome.
Right? His contribution to the war was nothing to sniff at as well. He was one of a team that worked together to develop the proximity fuse. So you know in like every cool video
wait, wait,
game.
Wait. You just said nothing to sniff at. But don't dogs sniff for bombs?
My man.
You do sniff
it.
For them.
You don't sniff for them.
But anyway, you're saying.
Yes.
Proximity fuse.
Proximity
what does that
fuse.
Do?
So like I remember playing. Did you have an N64 as a kid?
For the sake of the conversation, let's say yes.
Okay. There was a game on the N64 called Perfect Dark, and you could set it to play with just certain weapons in a round. So my oldest brother, Ben, his favorite thing
just
to do...
Grenades?
Not just grenades, even worse. His favorite thing to do would be to set up proximity mines, which go off when you get within a certain proximity
right.
of them. So you just carpet the entire place with mines. It's amazing. And that would not be possible without the work of J. Allen Hynek. That's what I'm trying to say here.
That's how I defeated Darth Treya in Knights of the Old Republic, too.
There you go.
Mines.
J. Allen Hynek.
All the mines throughout the entire video game that I collected.
He
could not beat
this.
Her any other way. Followed her in.
There you go. And unlike your, you know, pressure plate mounted mines, these were fuses that basically sent out a radio signal. Waited for the bounce back, and once that bounce back got short enough, it exploded. It was rated as like the third most important military development to come out of
World War II.
Yeah, he was a really important figure in that. Later on in his life, he would be consulted for things like how we're going to deal with Sputnik. You know, he was on the cover of Time magazine when Sputnik hit space and talking about the U.S., reaction to it. Yeah. Anyway, after the war, he came back to Ohio State University. He was a full-fledged professor at that point. However, of course, our primary interest in Hynek comes a few years after that, when in 1948, he was invited to act as astronomical consultant, first to Project Sign, and then eventually, ultimately, to Project Blue Book, which he fulfilled very well for 20 years. Now, Hynek served as the official government consult for astronomy for all of its official programs. He began working with Sign, like we said, in 1948. And when he did, he was a completely avowed skeptic.
Attaboy.
Yeah. He was the closest. The reason that he was picked initially, he was the closest to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base where Project Sign was being undertaken.
So literally right place, right time.
Right place, right time. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Are there multiple Patterson Air Force Bases? How many are there?
No, that's the joke. It's the Wright Pat, W-R-I-G-H-T.
Oh, gosh. Oh, man. Sam.
We're
that's,
really...
That's too high cognitive
we're
for
really
me this morning.
Not as funny as we think we are. But the other thing about it is during the war, because he was working on the proximity fuse, he was working on V2 rockets at places like the White Sands Laboratory, he had super high security clearance. So he was just, it was right place, right guy, right time, right Patterson Air Force Base.
I think it's funny. If thank no one else you. Appreciates thank it, you. I appreciate it.
I appreciate that. He would work on these programs until they were eventually shut down for good. Blue Book was eventually shut down for good in 1970. Now, he was a real and respected scientist, like we tried to explain. In fact, I ran into terrible, like super frustration when trying to research this section of the episode because all I got was how good of a scientist he was.
Why is this guy legit?
I tried to run searches on him before 1953, which of course was before the Robertson panel. And all I got so many newspaper articles, and they were all like, Dr. J. Allen Hynek talks about why Saturn is a great planet. Dr. J. Allen Hynek talks about stars. And they were great, but it's like, this really isn't helping my
needs. He's like
needs
the Neil deGrasse
right
Tyson of his time.
I suppose we could say that. He was an extremely well-respected individual, and he kept that well-respected individual persona up by, like we said, completely just skepticizing every bit of the UFO experience. Now, he was pretty good about it. He did his best to actually explain things and to not necessarily debunk as much as to investigate. But at the end of the day, there were a few different cases where he straight up just made something up. Or it seems like he may have made up an explanation.
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's birds.
Well, not even that. He, like, I don't even know. There was one where basically, and I think this was the one that happened right over in Emmett in Idaho, where a jet airliner saw all these different saucers. I think we talked about it last episode.
Nah, dude, they're cranes.
And, well, essentially he said it was a rare atmospheric eddy, which is something everyone was like, I've never heard of such a thing, Dr. Hynek. And he said, yes. Atmospheric Eddie,
that's
I'm
what he
sure.
did. That's what he did. He played with his beard and said yes.
Yes. And he never referenced that before.
See
he
how
never
I described
referenced
what
that.
He, did?
He never referenced that again. So, you know.
What do you call it again?
An atmospheric Eddie. Eddy. Now, Hynek methodically and systematically attempted to explain away everything that he could. He was skeptical, as he may be a real scientist, and while he was not, like we had mentioned, he was not one to simply disregard evidence and try to force it to fit with the facts, he did sometimes find those more colorful solutions. In the beginning of his work on Project Sign, Grudge, and Blue Book, though, he did suffer from one large bias, and it was that, in his own words, there was absolutely no way these things were extraterrestrial. It simply couldn't happen.
Man, I like this guy.
Right? You're not gonna.
I know.
It simply could not happen. And for that reason, he did end up ignoring and you know, reshaping some of his theories. They could not be it from anywhere other than this world. But he also suffered from the assumption that those making the reports could not be completely credible. However, in time, he would realize how flawed that assumption was. Essentially, if anybody claimed too out there, too much, the witness is flawed, not the science, right? And that's something that definitely develops as time goes on.
Okay. Which, I mean, that's fair.
It's totally fair. There's nothing wrong with it. Like I said last episode, the real trap is believing that 90% of the things in the skies are UFOs, right?
Yeah.
When it comes to Blue Book, you end up with less than 10% of things that end up truly unidentified, truly unexplained. But even within that, you have to be able to say, okay, if this is where we are, this is where we are.
Yeah,
where,
I think it's fair to say that generally we have a lack of knowledge of the natural world around us.
Mm-hmm. I think I agree. Now, quotes from his early days in ufology definitely follow up his position as a good researcher, but one who refused to let the extraterrestrial hypothesis flourish. He was quoted in the Montana Standard in 1952 as stating, "It's highly improbable that saucers came from another planet because, quote, that would be too vast a distance and too much of an engineering problem involved. And again, that's definitely more than fair. It's the exact same concern that many people share when it comes to the extraterrestrial hypothesis. However, despite his attempts to be open-minded, as we mentioned at the end of the last episode, he was a junior member of the Robertson Panel, which convened in 1953 and essentially put the good intentions of the United States ufological programs to bed.
Sorry, I'm going to cut you off real quick. So for me, the issue is the vast distances. Like, what's the point? Like, if I was an alien species looking at Earth.
Okay.
From so far away, like, best case scenario, maybe I'm seeing the dinosaurs and thinking, oh, that's really cool. I should go check those out.
Yeah.
And then they get here and they find
there's
us.
There's no dinosaurs.
And that is such a ripoff.
Can you blame them? They abduct people because they're like, what the hell?
You used to be a dinosaur.
You used to be 30 feet tall when I last saw you.
This was not the trip I signed up for.
Exactly.
Like, that's the problem is that, like, humanity is just so young of a species that if we are talking about someone that has traveled from a vast distance over space and time, then it's just such a long trip.
But I do feel like, isn't some of the closer habitable worlds, they're within the tens of light years away, you know?
Yeah.
Well, that's still a vast...
That's
no,
still,
I know, but I'm discounting...
You're going light speed.
Right. I'm discounting your dinosaur hypothesis.
Yeah, that's my hypothesis, and I'm sticking with it.
If they were able to somehow see that far, if they're only 40 light years away, they would just see us in 1970, and who wouldn't want to be on Earth in the 70s? That sounds
well,
great.
Well, so at this point in time right now,
yes.
So they saw the 1910s.
Who would? No, that's fair.
Who wants to be?
Who would want to be
in the 1910s?
I think that it is.
You gotta think about it. It's lawlessness. You have horses on the streets and cars at the same time. Lawlessness.
Thank you, Jason. I do think that the spaces are, of course, very vast. However, if these beings, if they are millions, if not billions, of years older than us. Maybe they know something we don't about traveling vast distances, you know? That's all I'm saying.
Then why stop here?
Well, but that's the thing is they didn't, because you get that argument all the time. Why stop here? Why come here? It's not like this is all they're doing. They haven't sat down and colonized the planet and took it over for some reason. They're just watching us the same way we're just watching Mars, you know? We're just seeing what happens.
Yeah, Mars is our next door neighbor.
Yeah, that's true. But we could be these people's like solar next door neighbor. You know, they could be from the next habitable solar system over, that sort of thing. And just saying, okay, what do we got going on here?
I'm just saying, I like where Hynek's going here.
Yeah.
Let's see his downfall.
Let's see his rise to stardom.
Sure. Now, two halves of a coin.
Now, despite his attempts to be open-minded, Hynek was a part of the Robertson panel. Now, two key pieces of the evidence that were presented to the Robertson panel were videographic evidence, two tapes that had been submitted. We're going to be linking to these in our show notes, and they are truly fascinating things.
Remind me of the Robertson panel again real quick.
The Robertson panel was the CIA-sponsored panel
that
from the start said there's nothing cool about UFOs. And then they took that.
So their grudge.
Their grudge. Yeah, okay. They're the CIA version of grudge. And it's them who caused Blue Book to turn from like open investigation into just straight up debunk everything and forget about the rest.
Okay.
Yeah. So the first film was taken by a Navy officer by the name of Delbert Newhouse while he was on vacation near Tremonton, Utah. Now, the film appears to show a small number of objects in the sky, about 10 of them, and they are moving in ways that are not consistent with any other known objects. The film had been reviewed by Navy video experts for over 1,000 man-hours.
1,000 hours?
Yeah. Well, man-hours. So 10 guys for 100 hours. But still, that's still insane, right? And it was confirmed by these experts that they're the objects that were seen could not be identified as birds, as planes, balloons, stars, or anything else. They even were able to theoretically confirm that the objects were self-luminous as well.
Do we know how long that film was?
Yeah, I've seen it. It's like a minute.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That is a boring 2 weeks of work.
Yeah, seriously. It's insane. That's crazy. You have to imagine that. You have to say it's a minute long film. They analyzed it for over 1,000 man hours. That's 60,000 times that film. Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Exactly. And yet, after the panel watched it twice, they were like, ah, it's Birds. It's got to be Birds. And Captain Ruppelt was like,
have you ever seen birds fly? They do crazy things in the air.
It's not Birds, guys. And Ruppelt was like, it's not Birds. And Hynek, as well, a junior member of the panel, he was like, it's probably not Birds, guys. But they said, no, it's Birds. Now, the second film was taken.
You've seen it, though, you said, right?
Yeah, and we'll be putting it in the show notes.
Wonderful.
It's pretty interesting stuff. Now, the second film was taken in Great Falls, Montana, by the owner of the local baseball team. And it showed two objects moving in tandem extremely quickly across the sky. Both films were observed several times by the panel. Like I said, the second film as well, it wasn't subjected to as much analysis, but they had done a little bit, and they said probably not Birds there either. Now, the first film, what it shows is essentially these objects like rotating in the sky and moving in very, very strange ways. The second object is just two objects moving quickly across the sky. So that,
like, they're tethered together at all?
They seem to be there the exact same distance apart the entire time, going the exact same speed.
It's weird.
It is very weird because it's not Birds. It doesn't seem like Birds, but that's what the panel said about both of them.
They're Birds, man.
They're Birds, man. Now, Hynek, to hear Hynek talk about it after the fact, he said essentially that the panel was sitting there and they kind of all made the internal decision. And of course they had been working with the CIA, they had been prepped by the CIA, and they essentially said they can't be unidentified objects. There's simply no way that they're unidentified flying objects, therefore they have to be Birds, even though it doesn't fit, even though it doesn't make a lot of sense. However, Hynek also said after the fact that while he had seen some things in the last 5 years that he believed that were unexplainable at the current, that there may have been better explanations for them out there, he felt that this was one of his main turning points. As he sat there and as he was wowed by these videos, and as he heard the analysis of the video experts, and then to have them say it's Birds, he said, and I quote, "I came away from the meeting and from the room with the distinct feeling, however, that the panel had deliberately moved to debunk the whole subject and not to give it the serious scientific attention which it deserved."
So this was his call to arms.
This was the beginning of his call to arms. It was perhaps the moment where he started being more comfortable with the unidentified hypothesis. You know, before this, he was putting things wherever he could fit them and this and that. But this is where he said, you know what? Some of these things are unidentified, and maybe that's okay. Maybe that's all right for now.
Unidentified or extraterrestrial?
Unidentified.
Okay.
Yes, very important distinction there. Now, shortly after the conclusion of the Robertson panel, Captain Ruppelt, like we mentioned, he packed his bags, headed off for greener pastures.
He
published a book a few years later called,
like one does.
I think it was like the Government Report on UFOs. That was initially just his time at Blue Book and delving deeper into the cases. 3 or 4 years later, the book was reissued with an additional three chapters, I think it was, and it was in those chapters that Ruppelt says, but UFOs are nothing anyway, so whatever. They're a space-age myth, is what he said. Doesn't really make sense. You don't really see why he would do that, but whatever. And then he died of a heart attack at age 37. So there's that. We're not going to really touch the conspiracy with a long stick here. But Blue Book would have four more project heads by the time it was finally shuttered in 1970. It began with Captain Hardin in March of 1954. However, he was really just the head of the project in name only. Essentially, after the Robertson panel, a new regulation, Air Force Regulation 200-2, was issued by General Nathan Twining. He had originally started Project Sign in 1947, and at that point, he had become the Air Force Chief of Staff. Now,
there you go.
Yeah, right? this regulation restructured how the Air Force was to conduct their investigations within Project Blue Book, as well as perform some changes to the technical aspect of the investigations, like what the formal definition of a UFO was. For instance, that definition, which is as far as I can tell the same one that is on the books today, is, and I quote, unidentified flying objects. And then for some reason...
Whoa, I thought you were going to tell me something different.
For some reason, they refer to them not as UFOs, but
why are you whispering about it?
Because this part isn't a quote. This is me personally. And then I'm going to put my quote voice back on in a second.
Okay.
But they refer to them not as UFOs, but UFOBs. UFOBs. Why? That's the government for you.
I don't know, man.
They just make things...
UFOBs?
They just... make things more difficult.
Yeah, why? What's the point of throwing in the B there?
No point. Off, right? Other than just to simply not be, to be able to simply say, we're not working with UFOs.
We're working with UFOs.
All right. And we're back. Unidentified flying objects relates to any airborne object which by performance, aerodynamic characteristics, or unusual features does not conform to any presently known aircraft or missile type, or which cannot be positively identified as a familiar object. Conjunctively, a familiar object was formally defined as balloons, astronomical bodies, birds, and so forth. So if it's not one of those things, it's an unidentified object. So that in and of itself doesn't sound like a big deal. And it doesn't sound wrong, right? What that does, though, is essentially it is an implied mandate to the people doing the investigation that what they are seeing are balloons, astronomical bodies, birds, and so forth, because there are no unidentified flying objects.
So what you're saying is that description in itself tells the team what things are.
Exactly. Now, the regulation also reinforced the original objective of Blue Book as being twofold, analyzing the possibility of UFOs as a threat to the United States and to determine the technical aspects involved. While all of this may sound mundane, it is important to remember that the official findings of the Robertson panel stated that, quote, there was no evidence of a direct threat to national security in the objects cited. However, here the government was funneling money and man hours into the pursuit of these questions, albeit a significantly lesser amount. Now, in addition, the regulation also stated that under no circumstances must details relating to unsolved cases be shared with the public, which was a departure from the Ruppelt era, where members of Blue Book at least had the authority to comment on unresolved cases, to mention, you know, theories and things there, even if it hadn't been proven yet.
So this is kind of shutting the doors.
Exactly. Exactly. Which is interesting because the Robertson panel had stated that what they needed to do was demystify it, as in open the doors. But in reality, it was simply shutting it.
How public was the panel? Was that something like televised?
No, it was not. It wasn't even known about until Ruppelt wrote his book and released it. Yeah. And then after that, they were like, okay, yeah, that happened. Yeah. It's not like we've been covering up UFOs, though. It's fine.
We're not covering anything up.
The last major change in the regulation that was that the investigation of UFO reports, instead of being undertaken primarily by Project Blue Book, was that these investigations would be undertaken by the 4602nd. I don't know how to like say that in right military speaks. So 4602nd. 4602. Yeah, 4602. Okay. The 4602nd Airborne Information Systems Squadron, which was headquartered in Ent Air Force Base in Colorado, but they shortly after moved to Fort Belvoir in Virginia. Now, this unit had 19 field units stationed throughout the country. And essentially what an Airborne Information Systems Squadron is a team of highly specified individuals whose entire object and goal is, for instance, let's say that a Soviet plane came down somewhere in the country. These would be the guys who go
to
the
response unit. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so essentially with the 19 different units that they had, it meant that they could get to anywhere in the country within 6 hours of a report being filed.
That's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool.
And so I'm assuming they just handle delicate matters like that.
So what it was, in, like that's what usual AISSs were. With the 4602, what it was, as opposed to them doing the only the highly specialized or the extremely, you know, sensitive matters.
Yeah, they hunted down and killed all the Jedi.
Yes. Instead, all reports went through the 4602 before being sent to Blue Book. Therefore, therefore, anything that they thought was sensitive or that they couldn't, they thought may end up as an unidentified.
So the government just kept it was back. Filtering the government.
Exactly. Yes, they were.
I love it.
Now,
bureaucracy.
They had the prerogative to send over only what they thought was important to be sent to Blue Book, which was the pretty much like surefire. Yeah, that was a planet,
or that was a crane.
Yeah, something like that. Now, the 4602 was also the only entity which had the authority to recommend further investigation to be made into any sighting or event, and it was theorized that it was the members of this unit who were the original Men in Black. Now, while Blue Book would occasionally be asked to follow up a sighting of a lesser importance, Captain Charles Hardin was not like his predecessor, Captain Ruppelt. Captain Hardin was happy to be stationed in a position with nothing to do, especially if the only thing to do had to do with UFOs. According to Ruppelt, Hardin believed that anybody who was interested in the UFO phenomena was completely crazy and found the whole thing boring.
That's it, Sam. We're crazy.
We're crazy. And UFOs are boring. That's the case. That's what we're looking at here.
Silly things in the sky.
Yeah.
You should be paying attention to what's right in front of you, Sam.
Thank you. I will. Don't lose sight of what's important. It's like a line from a drama about like a guy chasing UFOs, but then his wife leaves him, right? And she says something like that. That would be a good movie.
I mean, isn't that what happened to that guy from Skinwalker Ranch?
A lot of things happen to a lot of people at Skinwalker Ranch. Now, due to these new ways of classification, by the end of 1956, the number of unidentified sightings that went through Blue Book had dropped from 25% to less than 1%. Now, the following era, that of Captain George T. Gregory, was no more promising. Captain Gregory had been described as even more anti-UFO than Hardin, whereas Hardin simply did not care.
Is that actually a real name?
Great, George T. Gregory.
Look at it.
I know. It's great. GTG.
It's all right, if you say so.
Whereas Hardin simply did not care and couldn't be bothered to explain anything, Gregory actively worked against the ideas of UFOs. He was a classic debunker. And indeed, he stated that his mandate was to reduce the amount of true UFO reports to a minimum, as opposed to investigating anything at all. Now, he did this with one simple move. And when he does it, I just imagine...
chess set?
No, not even. I just imagined a smirk on his face when he does this, as if there's a big board. Imagine with me a big board and a pasty white guy in front of it.
Is it a chalkboard?
Sure.
Okay.
But no, it's like a whiteboard because you got magnets and stuff.
Okay, it's a whiteboard.
So imagine the whiteboard has four different sections, okay?
Yep.
On the left, you have unidentified.
Yep.
Followed by possible, followed by probable, followed by confirmed. So you'd have unidentified, and then you'd have a possible meteor or a probable plane or a confirmed bird. And that was how they pretty much structured all of their investigations. So what he did is he simply took a big, big ruler and he just slid everything over. If something was an unidentified object, it suddenly became a possible meteor. If it was a possible meteor, it became a probable meteor. And if it was a probable meteor, it became a confirmed meteor. And suddenly there were no more unidentified flying objects.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's some tough work there. I like it.
He worked
like, hey, maybe
hard.
This one was a meteor. It was a meteor.
I just imagine him saying, look, Pa, no more UFOs.
Maybe this is Ronald McDonald flying a spaceship.
I killed
it's
them
It's Ronald
all.
McDonald flying a spaceship.
Now,
that's.
I appreciate that visual.
You're welcome.
Now, unfortunately, these sorts of revisions.
Hamburger.
I'm so glad you're not sick anymore.
Oh, man, I'm back, baby. This is the low-grade quality you're hoping for.
Yep. This is a true episode of Not Alone.
Oh, man.
Now, unfortunately, these sorts of revisions and this new way of filing things, it became common across the board and pretty much changed the standard for Blue Book in perpetua. It didn't just end with Gregory. He had made a specific negative impact to how these things were handled. Now, Gregory would remain the head of Project Blue Book until 1958.
See, I feel just sad for all these subordinates. Like, they go from a guy that doesn't want anything to do with it to a guy that literally
hates it. And now they have to work.
Yeah, and it's to the point where it's like, okay, you're doing this for so long, and now you've got a completely different structure that you're doing it under. It's just pushing papers now.
But you have to remember that Blue Book was like four people.
These four people were pushing papers.
Because that's the thing. And in fact, I think we're going to, I'm actually going to say that right here. So now Captain Gregory would remain the head of Blue Book until 1958. When he left the project, he was replaced by Major Robert J. Friend. Bobby Friend.
Are you telling me that these are real people?
These are real people. They have Wikipedia pages. Major Friend, Captain Gregory.
Love it. All right.
Now, the entire time that all of this was going on, Hynek was the scientific advisor to Blue Book.
Sam, your mom made your frame.
Thanks, buddy. Now, although Hynek was a skeptic, he was a man who, at this point, especially after the Robertson panel, he genuinely wanted to get to the bottom of what was going on
here. Yeah, I can imagine some frustration. Just a little.
Yeah. The conclusions of the panel never sat well with him, and while he did not buy anything close to the idea that these were vehicles of non-terrestrial origin, or really even anything that could not be well and truly explained, he realized and recognized that the explanations that were being given were subpar, to say the least. He was also extremely unhappy with the way that Blue Book was being handled by the government, and he would say at a later date in his book, The UFO Experience, A Scientific Inquiry, quote, "The popular impression through the years was that Blue Book was a full-fledged serious operation. The public perhaps envisioned a spacious, well-staffed office with rows of file cabinets, a computer terminal for querying the UFO data bank, and groups of scientists quietly studying reports attended by a staff of assistants. The actual situation was unfortunately the opposite. The operation was generally headed by an officer of a lesser rank. In the military, the importance attached to a mission is usually in direct proportion to the rank of the commanding officer. The relatively low-ranking officers in charge of Blue Book were usually assisted by a lieutenant and sometimes only by a sergeant. For one long period of time, a sergeant with little technical training was given the chore of evaluating most of the incoming reports."
And all those people fought for the computer in order to play Snake.
Were you thinking about that the entire time? Were you just like, how can I turn this into a joke?
The one computer terminal.
But that's what he's saying, was that there was no computer terminal.
Oh, no.
They couldn't even
play Snake by hand.
How does that even work, Jason?
Well, you get a box.
Okay.
You get a snake.
Go, God.
And then he gets some mice.
it was safe to say he was definitely not in favor of how Blue Book was being run. And while he did not have the power to secure more funding for Blue Book, one of his biggest problems with the program was not necessarily the lack of resources, but rather the lack of enthusiasm and good science when it came to the investigations. Now, that's why when Major Friend took over Blue Book, Hynek found himself at least a little encouraged, a little heartened, and even hopeful that a positive change was on the way. Friend, at the very least, didn't seem to be contemptible towards the subject of UFOs and seemed as though he did take his job seriously, much like at the end of Project Grudge, Lieutenant Cummings. Remember, he was trying his best, and although he had gotten a bad lead-up, he was doing what he could to actually investigate these things. It was very similar with Major Friend.
Major Friend. I gotta say, man, you a major friend.
I hate you so much. All right.
Bobby, I'm sorry. This is who I am.
This
is awful.
Now, Dr. Hynek approached Major Friend and suggested that some of the older reports that had been closed as unidentified should be reopened and examined in an attempt to move them into the identified category. While Friend seemed open to this idea initially, he found all of his all of his best attempts thwarted by a lack of funding and resources, of which his requests for increase of salary, increase of positions, were summarily denied. Now, although there is evidence that Major Friend was perhaps trying the most out of anybody since Ruppelt, he would come to bear the brunt of the public outcry against the government's mishandling of UFO investigations up to that point. And his accusers was the organization NICAP, or...
Kneecap?
Nope, NICAP, also known as the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, which is a very official-sounding name for a group of dudes.
I really thought you were going to say kneecap just for me.
Nope, I'm not. A group of dudes who got together to talk about UFOs all the time. NICAP was formed in 1956, and according to their literature, one of the main goals for their formation at that time was the pressing for congressional hearings as a step towards bringing scientific attention to UFOs. They did this, and this isn't fair, but I wrote it this way, and I'm going to say it this way. They did this by being what I can only assume that I will one day become: true wackadoo.
There it is.
Now, again, it's not fair. It's not fair to say that they were just crazy people. You had former members of the government, members of the military, scientists, really good, dedicated, intelligent people, very fine people in NICAP. But what they were doing was essentially writing letters every week to their congressmen saying, let's get some hearings. Let's do
this. At least they're vocal.
Exactly. They care. They started their existence by finding out exactly how many individuals in Congress agreed that UFOs were a big deal and needed to be taken seriously. And without much surprise, they found that the answer were not that many.
One hand, two hand? How many?
Probably like a two-hander, I would say. Okay. But still. Now, the organization of NICAP, though, began sending mail consistently to members of Congress individually, as well as addressing the general body of Congress.
And they got the same, sure, response that we did.
I'm sure that they did.
Oh, man.
But at their height, NICAP had 14,000 extremely dedicated members.
Whoa, that's a lot of people.
It is a lot of people.
That's huge growth.
Yeah.
So when did they start again?
1956, and they hit those numbers by 1960.
Wow.
So, yeah, they grew
UFO
pretty fast.
UFO craze.
Mm-hmm. And because they were getting mail and they were getting messages, and again, to NICAP's credit, it wasn't just, you need to look at UFOs, you need to look at UFOs. They sent them their evidence, and they sent them the cases. And slowly but surely, they gained a lot. We'll actually link to all of the statements by members of Congress and the Senate. There's got to be dozens in there of people responding to NICAP, eventually saying, you know, I think you might be right. I think there is something that may be going on here that we need to look at. And to that respect, they officially filed their official report to Congress on June 21st, 1960, which again, we'll be linking. In this 11-page report, they claim that one of the main concerns they have regarding UFOs is that they may be mistaken for Soviet aircraft and inadvertently start a war. They also claimed that the Air Force had been intentionally covering up the seriousness and perhaps the overall existence of the UFO phenomena, especially when it came to members of Congress and the Senate. Now, they cited a number of cases that they had in their files as having been confirmed to be investigated by the Air Force that received either undesirable final reports or, alarmingly, that they had been told at later dates had never occurred. Now, they claim that the Air Force was operating in a way that they found to be needlessly secretive and even potentially harmful to national security. NICAP kept fantastic records and was able to provide proof of some of the following encounters, or of the following encounters, which is some of the ones they put in that letter.
So how did they receive all this information? Was there a leak in the government?
No, they would go in and they'd witness, or they'd interview the witnesses, and uh-huh. A lot of the witnesses were military. And they would talk to him. They would sign statements.
So
how
did they pick up on it? Was it just from like newspaper articles and stuff?
Yeah, that's primarily how it was. UFOs, it used to be that whenever there was a UFO sighting, it was in the papers. You know, nowadays people see UFOs, they go on the internet, they put them there.
Right.
You might have a one paragraph blurb on your newspaper's website, but it doesn't make print. It used to be front page news all the time. And that was essentially what they chased up. And...
Cold War, Roswell.
Yeah, totally.
Makes sense.
It does. We'll be talking about one specifically that they found through the newspapers. But this first case is potentially one of the most interesting I've ever heard of. And they do. They have proof of its existence. So this case is that of Felix Moncla, a first lieutenant in the Air Force. And on the evening of November 23rd, 1952, Air Defense Command radar operators at Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, made contact with an unusual target near the Sioux Locks, which was a series of locks that allowed ships to navigate between Lake Superior and the lower Great Lakes. Now, Moncla was stationed at the nearby Kinross Air Force Base, and he flew an F-89C Scorpion jet, which was scrambled to intercept the UFO, which had been clocked at about the speed of a jet airliner at that point.
That sounds like a cool jet.
Mm-hmm. Now, radar operators tracked both Moncla and the UFO with no issues. It wasn't like last week where we were talking about, it's going faster than we can track. It was completely consistently there. Both objects were. They were able to get a good lock on both of them. And as Moncla and his radar operator approached the object at an altitude of 8,000 feet, they begin to see these two blips on the screen back at the base. They begin to see them moving closer and closer and closer and closer. And they're talking to Moncla and they say, do you see it? And he says, I don't see anything. And closer and closer. And suddenly the two blips intercept and become one blip. And Moncla stops talking. They cannot get him to respond. And they're worried that there was a collision.
Right.
But this one blip now, who's to say which one it was, just continues on with no change in direction, distance, or direction, speed, nothing to indicate that it had been hit or anything at all
Hold on. So they weren't going the same direction, right? He intercepted.
He intercepted.
Right.
So that's what.
So which continued
the
on?
The UFO.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay now.
Yeah. It was as if Moncla came underneath or above the UFO and then readjusted his position in midair and then followed directly underneath it.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. But that's not what happened at all.
That's scary. Did he dock in it?
He did not dock in it. No.
Darn.
Now, the operators expected after a minute or so that these blips would they expected it within seconds, but they thought, okay, these things have to separate if even just to see Moncla or the UFO go down. But there was no separation. The singular blip on the screen showed no sign of slowing down and simply continued in the same speed and heading that it had been until it flew out of range of the radar. Now, search and rescue was immediately scrambled. The point of impact was directly over Lake Superior, but Moncla, as well as his radar operator, Lieutenant R.R. Wilson, both would have had life vests, inflatable rafts, flares.
Right.
And they said, oh, you know, if it's a crash, we can do it. We can probably find them. The Air Force and the Royal Canadian Air Force both scoured the area that the supposed impact had occurred and found absolutely no trace of the men or the plane. And to this day, have never found anything.
Whoa.
Yeah. Now, NICAP has evidence of this occurring. They have the letters that were written. Here's the heartbreaking part. Moncla had become a father just like six months
before. Of course.
I know. It's like out of a freaking movie, man.
It
sucks. So they have letters that were written to his wife and to his mother and to his brothers and stuff like that saying, you know, this is what happened and this is our official report of what happened.
What was it, a training accident?
No.
Used all over again.
Right. It was, well, so when NICAP went to talk to them about it, they were like, this never happened. You're foolish. You're not. Yeah, this never happened. There was no such event. And then later on, they said, okay, this did happen. Okay. But what happened was there was a Royal Canadian Air Force plane and they crashed. And the Royal Canadian Air Force said, that's not true at all. We had nothing in the air. We lost no plane. We recorded no incidents of a plane hitting another plane. That's simply not what happened.
Man, dude, that was a cool plane.
Yeah, right?
I wonder how
and
much
that was a human
right
life.
That's that too.
They also recorded oral statements from members of the Air Force And they provided this evidence to Congress. And that was one of the big cases that Congress said, what the heck's going on? It is one of the craziest things I've ever heard. Now, another interesting case that they put forward comes from April 8th.
You know, the aliens were probably like, that's a really cool jet.
A man is dead.
We don't know that.
Well, that's true. We don't know
that. We don't
that.
Know that.
We don't
he
know
just
that.
Been abducted. There was, he might have had a very, like, fulfilling life after that.
There was even a hoax.
Fingers crossed.
There was even a hoax that came out of this, essentially, like, in two, I think it was 2006.
He wanted the jet for himself, didn't he?
No.
Okay.
In 2006, people started getting emails from this company. It was called, like, the Great Lakes Diving Company. And they were photos of what appeared to be this jet underwater. And they said, we found this at the bottom of Lake Superior. And they set up all these news interviews and stuff like that.
Really?
But when people traced it, the Great Lakes Diving Company didn't exist. And the individual, I can't even remember his name, but the one that they had been in
That's
contact
amazing.
With, yeah, never existed. And then when all of these interviews were supposed to happen, just didn't hear back. And so everyone was like, what the heck? And then they looked and they were like, these photos seem super fake, actually, now that we're looking at them. So it's something that happened on his – he had a memorial in Sacred Heart Cemetery in Morroville, Louisiana. It says, in loving memory of – apparently his first name was actually Gene, but he went by Felix. So in loving memory of Gene Felix Eugene Moncla Jr., First Lieutenant, United States Air Force, born October 1926, disappeared November 23rd, 1953, intercepting a UFO over Canadian border as pilot of a F-89 jet plane. Yeah. Another extremely interesting case comes from April 8th, 1956. Now, on that day, there was a captain named Raymond L. Ryan who saw a UFO, but the difference is that this captain was not a military captain. He was working and a captain for, or a pilot for, American Airlines.
Oh, good old Ray Rye.
Okay. he encountered a fast-moving UFO just west of Albany, New York, and he radioed Griffiths Air Force Base, expecting to be told either there's nothing to worry about or, worst-case scenario, you know, you need to leave because you need to reroute your flight because of military training exercises. But to his shock, he was ordered to abandon his flight plan and to aid in intercepting the UFO, which he did. Now, according to the story that was published in the Buffalo Evening News of April 10th, 1956, and was cited as evidence by NICAP in addition to additional testimony, Captain Ryan claimed that the chase had lasted 45 minutes.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Now, the UFO appeared as a large bright light hovering over Schenectady, New York, around 10:15 p.m. As they approached, others saw the light as well, including members of the crew. They all remarked on the brightness of the light, with Captain Ryan claiming that it was almost too bright to look at because it hurt your eyes. Now, it was a very bright light, but would change occasionally to a dimmer orange. As they approached, moving at 240 miles an hour, the object suddenly took off at an estimated 900 miles per hour. Once it had gotten a ways away from the jet, it dropped its distance to keep its speed. Once the call had been made to the Air Force, they essentially ordered the plane to go dark, which is definitely not a safe thing to do, and not what you, as an airline pilot, if you're listening to this, please don't go dark. They said, turn off all your lights except the very minor essential ones that you need to be able to navigate and follow that UFO. Now, he continues to see the light in the distance, and essentially it does. It drops its speed and keeps the exact same distance from the plane. So if the plane's going 240 an hour, it's going 240 an hour. Now, the Air Force also scrambled other jets to pursue the craft. Ryan was confirmed to by the pilots of those jets that they, too, were seeing the aircraft. And Ryan continued to pursue the object until it began to pass closely to Canadian airspace, at which point he says, I'm not going over there. I don't think I'm allowed to go over there. And also, I'm not going to catch this thing. It can obviously outmaneuver my plane. Now, the article ends with a quote from Captain Ryan, and it says, quote, I've read about fantastic flying saucers, and I'm the type of fellow that, well, you've got to show me. But I'm convinced there was something fantastic up there. This is real, brother. This is absolutely real. Which is very interesting. All right, because, brother. Right? I know, I love him. It's very interesting because when NICAP later attempted to speak with Captain Ryan, it was months later, but Ryan said, that never happened. And the Air Force said, that never happened. And they said...
Wait. That was an airliner, though, right?
It was an American Airlines airliner.
So there was people on the airline.
And the people on the airline said that this happened, and the crew said that this happened, and they had a taped recording of Captain Ryan.
You can't have everyone this hushed up.
Right. You had a taped recording of Captain Ryan telling this story that he said happened. And if it never happened, why didn't I think it's the Buffalo Daily or Evening News.
Why were they so late to their destination?
The Buffalo News source, they were never asked to retract any part of it. They were never asked to change it. They simply said it didn't happen, even though there was all of this evidence, all of these statements that it had. Now, this was this was cited as a major cover-up by NICAP.
No, it's a horrible cover-up.
It is a terrible cover-up.
It's like the one thing you can't cover up. There's too many people. There's too many threads.
It's entirely true, but they tried nonetheless. And it was just interesting to me. I love how at the end of the article and in this interview that they have taped with him, he says, this is real. This is absolutely real. And then just does it completely 180, not just saying, you know, the common thing to say would be, oh, I was wrong. It was a star or something. No, he didn't say that.
It was some weird play of light.
He just said it didn't happen. And the other thing that's really more concerning about it is that he provided, and American Airlines provided, like, flight log inventory that showed that he had arrived on time and all of this, even though multiple other witnesses said that they hadn't, which shows that somebody was lying in a way that was not just, oh, yes and no, he said, she said. Somebody was potentially forging records that would have had to be submitted to the FAA. So that's not a great way to start.
That's why I always fly Southwest.
Yes, they're an honorable company. In conjunction with this sort of cover-up idea, NICAP alleged that the public was being straight up lied to as well. They cited multiple examples. Let me just try that again. NICAP also alleged in this report to Congress that the public was being straight up lied to by the Air Force, and they cited multiple examples. One such example was a statement made by the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force, one R.E. Horner, on a nationwide telecast of the Armstrong Circle Theater, which aired January 22, 1958 on CBS. His quote was, quote, there has been a mistaken belief that the Air Force has been hiding from the public information concerning unidentified flying objects. Nothing could be further from the truth, and I do not qualify this in any way.
What's up with that voice?
I just feel like that's what
is that your like
fuddy-duddy from the Air Force would say.
Ah, yeah. A fuddy-duddy.
Fuddy-duddy. Now, 24 hours later, a member of NICAP, one Larry W. Bryant, received a letter from an Air Force public information officer stationed at Langley Air Force Base by the name of G.H. Oldenburg. In this letter, it stated, the public dissemination of data on unidentified flying objects is contrary to Air Force policy and regulations. And then he cited the previously referenced Regulation 200-2. NICAP also stated that the objects could not be of Soviet origin due to the way that they behaved in ways that were not consistent with the physics of our world as we understand them. They stressed the importance of understanding that the cases that they were referencing were vetted. Almost all of them were sightings by members of the military, and a good amount of them involved both radar evidence and photo and video evidence as well. Things like UFOs traveling at speeds exceeding 18,000 miles per hour witnessed visually and on radar in broad daylight in places like White Sands, New Mexico, which, if you know anything about White Sands, New Mexico, you know that we have a great big missile range there.
There we go.
And that's also where we did our first nuclear test. That's the first place an atomic bomb was ever detonated on the face of the Earth. Reports of a UFO traveling at 9,000 miles per hour tracked on the radar of a B-29, which appeared to show other smaller objects around it, merging with it as if it were a mothership of some kind. Come back, Mongla. We miss you. NICAP also concluded for similar reasons that there was no way these objects were American-made either, citing specifically accounts from World War II regarding silver disc-like craft, as well as the fact that by Air Force's budget, reports they were spending about $10,000 per major case to investigate, as well as the fact that they were sometimes firing upon these craft. Now, especially during the Cold War, when military superiority was such an active part of our daily lives, it would also make no sense to keep these things a secret. And now, almost 60 years later, for us to still have nothing even close to the objects disclosed, it further strengthens the idea that these are not military vehicles. NICAP ends their report saying that they believe these machines to be truly interplanetary. The letter was signed by former Marine Corps Major Donald E. Kehoe, which is a name you might remember from our episode on Rendlesham Forest. Now, that letter ends with this, quote, NICAP urges that the Congress insist, one, that the opinions of the NICAP majority and recognized experts and the interplanetary conclusions and supporting evidence be immediately made public in the public interest, that and also then, two, that every effort be made to secure immediate release of the hidden Air Force evidence as official proof that the UFOs could not be Russian, that this evidence also include the top-secret Air Force intelligence estimate of the situation, which you should remember from last week, which is that the UFOs are interplanetary spaceship. Existence of this conclusion was disclosed by Captain Ruppelt in 1956. Top Air Force officers and headquarters spokesmen have repeatedly denied it in letters to Congress and the public. NICAP is prepared to produce a signed statement by Major Dewey Fournette, USAFR, former intelligence monitor for the UFO program, that the document referred to was drawn up and was kept secret. It is realized that some public uneasiness might follow an official Air Force admission, but NICAP's research indicates that there would be no widespread hysteria at the interplanetary answer, unless the Air Force created suspicion by withholding some of its evidence. It is true, some cases might appear to indicate hostility. The Kinross case, the death of Captain Mantell in a UFO chase, near collisions on airways when airline pilots unavoidably injured passengers in evading unknown objects, etc. But evaluation of thousands of reports give no proof of belligerence. If the Air Force releases its evidence now without waiting for a possibly Soviet-inspired emergency, the public probably will accept a frank answer that censorship was invoked in the public interest until more answers were known. And then, as we all know, the government released all of its UFO files and the Air Force said they're aliens, dudes, and we all just were chill with it.
All right, so the end. Our dimension, in our universe, I love how they gave them a cop-out. They're like, here, just say this.
Yeah.
We have it written for you.
Yeah. And they and I what I really liked, and the reason that I put that entire part in here.
So a recap on the NICAP.
A recap on the NICAP recap of the report is the reason that I put that in there is because of that statement they say where is it? NICAP's research indicates there would be no widespread hysteria at the interplanetary answer. Which I really feel like it in this day and age, while it would definitely be shocking, I feel like one of the major arguments that people say is that the government is covering it up, if they're naive, the government is covering it up out of good intentions and because they don't want people to freak out and go crazy, and they cite, you know, the War of the Worlds broadcast where people supposedly ended up killing themselves over this alien invasion. I don't think that's going to be the case. I think that when it happens, everyone's going to be a little shocked. You're going to have people, extreme skeptics, maybe even like you, Jason, who say, I don't care if the government says it's interplanetary. It's not interplanetary. And there's going to be people like me who are saying, I told you all. But
I think pop culture has eased that enough for us, mm-hmm, with Star Trek, Star Wars.
Which, if you look at the conspiracy theories, not that I agree with these specific ones, But they state that that's the point of Star Trek and that's the point of Star Wars, is to prepare us for contact and prepare us for this unraveling. And
Star Trek, maybe. Star Wars.
Yeah, Star Wars is not. Star Trek, I could totally see it because it's a beautiful show about humans interacting with non-humans in extremely human ways.
Yeah. Star Wars is just a fantasy film. Stupid.
Star Wars isn't stupid. I'm sorry. I apologize. Star Wars.
Yeah, you
is Star
on
Wars.
Toes there, dude.
Yeah, I apologize. I do. I don't think that there would be a big outcry. I think the outcry would be, if you've known this for 60 years now, why are we just hearing about it now? You know, but it it goes to show that there's a lot of information out there regarding this cover up, this conspiracy theory. That while I may not buy into every part of it, I think it's at least true at its basic core that the government is not telling us everything, and that the government is trying their best to cover it up. And when they get called out, they get called out. But who's to say what they haven't been called out on? You know. Anyway, now the report was received favorably by quite a few members of Congress and the Senate, who did find themselves intrigued and even alarmed by the contents of the NICAP report. NICAP would eventually get their UFO hearings, but not for a few years yet. However, the letters did, for those years, prompt an increase in the Blue Book budget and increase in its personnel. However, like before, after a few years after it was out of the spotlight, the money eventually ran out, the lawmakers got bored, and Blue Book underwent another change in leadership.
No, not Major Friend.
Yep, Major Friend had been vilified by the ufological community, despite being the most reasonable and responsible head of Blue Book in years. He resigned, claiming that due to the government's inability to properly fund and manage the project, it was completely useless and ought to simply be dissolved. However, Friend believed in the authenticity of UFOs and the need for them to be researched for the rest of his life. I don't know if he's still alive, to be straight. He gave a interview in 2012 to the Huffington Post where he says exactly that. These things are real, they're serious, we need to take them seriously. According to UFO researcher Jerome Clark, by this point, Blue Book had lost all of its credibility. The new appointed head of Blue Book did not help this perception in the least, as it was to find itself under the worst leader yet.
So it just became a joke.
It became a punchline. And it really, truly, as we'll see here, became a joke. Just that. You couldn't.
So it became Project Kelly Blue Book.
Yes, Project Kelly Blue Book. What was it? People referred to it as...
That spaceship over there is worth...
The explanations of the uninvestigated, as opposed to the investigations of the unexplained. Which I think is fair, based
That's
on...
That's depressing.
It is super depressing.
All right, well... Glorious end. Tell me about it.
So... After Friend left, Major Hector Quintanilla, we're going to say that. I'm sure it's a mispronunciation.
Fair.
Took over Blue Book in August of 1963. He was happy to take over the debunking efforts back into full swing after the period of attempted investigation and explanation by Major Friend. However, there was a major difference between Major Quintanilla and his predecessors as far as the debunking campaign goes. As opposed to being opposed to UFOs in general, and even spiteful towards those who claim to witness them, according to multiple individuals, Quintanilla was simply not competent enough to hold this position. He didn't have the know-how. He didn't understand how it worked.
And Hynek's been here through and through.
Hynek has been here the entire time, watching this project
just disintegrate.
Break, yeah,
yeah.
And according to Hynek, he says, quote, during Air Force Major Hector Quintanilla's tenure as Blue Book's director, the flag of the utter nonsense school was flying at its highest on the mast.
I want that flag.
Right?
I want that flag.
The utter nonsense
so much.
School. We can make it. We have the technology. Now, as opposed to forcing sightings into predetermined boxes based on what fit the facts best, Quintanilla and his subordinates would just label the sightings whatever they wanted. For instance, one individual, Sergeant David Moody, according to Hynek, would throw everything into what he referred to as the crackpot category, referring to them as psychological breaks from reality, only there was absolutely no other thing that he would label them as. Now, these sorts of attitudes drew some of the strongest criticisms of Blue Book to date. Criticism was so strong not only because of the terrible explanations, but also because more and more compelling UFO stories were finding their way into the public realm of knowledge and then immediately being botched by the Blue Book investigations. Now, for instance, there was a flap in the summer of 1965 through the Midwest and Southeast areas of the United States. Hundreds of reports came in from people all over the place. Egg-shaped craft were seen in Texas. In Oklahoma, UFOs were charted on radar descending 18,000 feet in a matter of seconds. Meteorologists were even seeing things on their weather radars. Quintanilla and his squad of goons, his goon squad, explained that every single...
Well, Hynek's a part of that goon squad right now.
Not necessarily. Not as much.
Oh, did he bring in his own crew?
So Hynek, the thing about it, Hynek worked for the government.
Right.
Hynek was not free to say what he actually
was
thought.
Was he a civilian consultant, or was he like legitimately like on their payroll?
He was on the government's payroll. He was not allowed to say what he thought publicly about these things.
Right.
He had his own private ideas, but they never came to light until after Blue Book was over.
Okay.
And so, yes, technically he could be perceived as part of Quintanilla's goon squad. He wasn't actually. But, well, he was sometimes. We'll get into that.
Okay.
But, essentially, Quintanilla says that every single report, again, hundreds of people from multiple states seeing different things, multiple different things, every single report had either been the planet Jupiter or a very bright star like Betelgeuse or Rigel. People were in shock. It was so stupid that they didn't know what to say. In Oklahoma, where the objects were regularly being spotted on radar at the Tinker Air Force Base, the director of Oklahoma Science and Art Foundation Planetarium stated, quote, "That is about as far from the truth as you can get. These stars and planets are on the opposite side of the Earth from Oklahoma City at this time of year. The Air Force must have had its Starfinder upside down in August." And others noted, rightfully so, that stars don't appear on radar.
What? They don't?
Right?
Oh,
this
man.
Was...
I was using my radar all wrong.
This was one of the biggest, really one of the biggest things where people just started screaming cover-up. Going from, well, the government just doesn't care over this or that, to just screaming cover-up. In reality...
Because it's so sloppy.
Exactly. In reality, it is that the government didn't care. It wasn't a cover-up.
Right,
These people just refused to put the work in, you know. Now, another case, and
How
one
dare
of...
these people.
Right? One of the most interesting cases that I've ever heard, another one that drew public criticism of Blue Book occurred in 1966 on the morning of April 17th at around 5 a.m. Now, that was when, while checking out an abandoned vehicle on the side of State Route 224 in Portage County, Ohio, Dale Spar and his partner William Wilbur Neff had their own close encounter with the unknown. These were both police officers. Now, Spar noticed a glowing craft levitating out of the nearby woods. It got above the tree line and then began to move towards them slowly. They stated that it was shaped like an ice cream cone on its side and made a sound like an overloaded transformer. It exuded extreme heat, which they felt as it passed overhead.
Poor ice cream cone.
Then, as if following the road, it slowly started moving east down the 224. When they radioed into dispatch, they were told to follow the damn thing. They took off in pursuit, and the object appeared to match their speed with ease, even as they pushed over 100 miles per hour. However, when they would come to a traffic light or when they would be slowed by the flow of traffic, the object would stop or slow down with them. It was witnessed by a number of motorists on the road as well. Another cop car joined them in pursuit along the way, and the two vehicles and three men tailed the craft for 86 miles before they were finally forced to stop for gas. A fourth police officer was waiting for them at the gas station, and all four of them saw the UFO hover near the service station, hang there for a moment, and then dart up into the sky and disappear. All along the way, the men had been taking photographs, and they claimed that the object would even dip as close to like 50 feet off the ground at some points. Now, Blue Book came into town and briefly interviewed one of the police officers, then confiscated all the photographs and left. They made their official ruling days later when Quintanilla stated that what had been seen was the planet Venus. The planet Venus.
He does know what planets are, right?
Right? Every person involved rejected this completely. And unfortunately, Spar went crazy over it. He lost his job. His marriage disintegrated. He spent the rest of his life pretty much completely miserable. He did name the UFO Floyd, though, which I think is probably my favorite thing I've ever heard.
That's lovely.
Right? Floyd. He essentially, what happened is he stopped being a cop. He had to work in the mines. In the mines, he broke his back, literally. Then he opened a bar, and at the bar, he'd just be sad all the time. And when people came in, he'd be like, let me talk to you about Floyd. The son of a... ruined my life.
Oh my gosh.
These sorts of cases, though, as far, you know, the public outcry was huge. And that's a big part of it. That's important, for sure. But they served one other extremely important facet in the grand ufological story. In addition to emboldening the public to reject the government's explanations of UFOs, to demand further investigation, they also began to turn some part of our man, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, away from his position as an Arctic skeptic and into a believer. Although he was not quite there yet, he was becoming certain that at least a few of these cases weren't only unidentified, weren't just unidentified objects, but were also objects that potentially could not come from this world.
Oh,
Hynek began delving into cases that were officially not worthy of Blue Book's time. He spent time interviewing individuals who not only saw craft, but also saw occupants inside and outside of them. There are dozens of cases that could be pointed to as the cause of Hynek's conversion and the decision to study these things that had been altogether ignored by the Air Force up until that point, but there are two cases we're going to focus on specifically. Now, in the interest of time, because I ran a Twitter poll and the people almost unanimously said, I do not want a 3-hour long episode.
Neither do I.
Right? We are going to break here. We are going to pick this up next week. And if I can do it, if I can make it work, we're going to cover the end of Blue Book to the present day, which really is not as much information as one might think it is.
It's 40 years.
It's 40 years, but it about as much happens in that 40 years that we're going to be covering as happened in the last 10 years put together, right? Last 20 years, technically, with Blue Book.
Okay.
So we will be moving forward. We'll be hitting some of the landmark cases. But of course, if we tried to cover everything that happened with UFOs between then and now, this would be the rest of our lives. If you are interested in that, please go listen to Rob's show, Our Strange Skies, where he is going to do exactly that.
You know, it's probably the fact that they got here and the ETs realized that there aren't any more dinosaurs and they're done. They went home.
Oh, good Lord.
That might have been it.
That could, you know, you might be on to something
there,
Jason.
I would travel to another planet to see dinosaurs.
I totally would as well. I totally would. I would also go to Jurassic Park.
Yeah, exactly. They picked up their copy of Jurassic Park, called it a day, and headed out.
Copy of, wait, the book or the movie or the movie or the movie or the movie?
Why not both?
Okay. Four movies and a book. I like it. That's what the aliens took home. So that is where we're going to leave it this week. Now, ironically, next week we're going to be picking up with the entire reason why we did these episodes. We essentially, what it came down to is that I wanted to do one UFO sighting, one close encounter.
Oh God, really? It was just one?
I wanted to do
what
one.
What happened?
And it
got derailed.
I was oscillating between these two options, okay? And I'll tell y'all just so you know, and if you want to do some research, you can do some research, whatever. It's the cases of Father Gill, a reverend who was stationed in Papua New Guinea, and Lonnie Zamora, a policeman in Socorro, New Mexico. I was oscillating between these two, and then somehow my brain reached such a high frequency that it broke apart and said, just do all of it. And that's where I've been for the last 2 weeks. I have written 18,000 words on UFOs in the last two and a half weeks. I'm tired, but we're going to do this. We're going to make it. We're going to make this a three-parter. I'm going to kill it next week. We're never going to talk about UFOs again for another month, and then we're going to do another UFO story.
This whole line of discussion is literally to give
us a base. Literally just so that I can talk more about UFOs. Yeah. We have to get through this yeah,
so that we have all understanding what Sam's going to be talking about
exactly
later.
I have to do this occasionally where – like with Skinwalker Ranch, I have to look at something so much that I'm sick of it for a while. And then that way, when I come out of it, I feel like I know more. And I feel like I actually have learned. So, and I hope you guys are too. You know, these are good-sized episodes. They're fairly large, but and it's a departure from our usual, like, typically what we have really is a story that can be told in about 30 minutes,
yeah,
maybe even 25 minutes.
And then banter.
And a lot of banter. And now we're looking at things where it's taking hours to even tell the story. So I really hope you guys are enjoying it. If you're not, too bad. I'm sorry. Let me know for sure. But we're into this and we're not pulling up.
Well, you've kept me interested, Sam.
So I asked,
well done.
I asked you at the end of last episode. I'm going to ask you at the end of this episode.
Oh, dear, what you ask me.
Has anything that I've talked about today changed your perspective on UFOs?
Not quite yet, no.
Really?
Nope.
Why don't – just so
they're
that
– interesting.
Just so that we're completely sure. Unambiguous, because I don't even know if I know the answer to this. What is your perspective on UFOs?
I don't think little green men have visited us.
Totally fair. Unless we're going to talk about the Kelly Hopkinsville encounter, which we are.
Of course.
Not next week, though.
I could imagine, like, say, unmanned drones or something like that, but I don't think physical alien beings have landed.
But where are the drones coming from?
Okay, I'm not saying that aliens don't exist.
Right.
I just don't think one has stepped on Earth.
Okay, so you don't think there's ever been an alien? So you're very much like, exactly like I was saying last episode, you're very much like Captain Ruppelt, right? Where you say, something's going on here, but it cannot possibly be that these there cannot be beings associated with the craft.
Correct. I think that is such a first off, I mean, if you are going to make a drone, life support systems are so much more expensive and harder to keep up. Why would you send, if you have the ability to travel through space, why would you send a crew as well when you just do it all remotely?
I agree. Why'd we go to the moon? Foolish.
Because that's the only tech that we had.
That's fair.
Because our drones now are a whole lot better than what we had back then.
Yeah.
I mean, we went to the moon with essentially the computing power of a calculator.
Isn't
that
crazy?
Which is ridiculous. Oh, my God.
I know. This phone, the same phone that I threw earlier in the episode.
It's hundreds of times more powerful than what sent us to the moon.
Although, wait, what?
As it grasps your attention. It sucks you
You're
in.
You're right. Well, I saw something from MoviePass, and I saw something that said the end, and what? I thought that it was saying MoviePass was shutting down. That's not the case. MoviePass has changed my life, and I love it so much. All right.
I got to get on that train.
Oh, you got it. It's such a good train to be on. Yeah, although, you know what my uncle told me and then proved and then cited his sources is that somehow we have lost, quote unquote, lost all of the scientific data, all the calculations and stuff that took us to the moon. The math is all gone. Seems like something pretty important, doesn't it?
That's weird.
Seems like something you'd want preserved, isn't it? I'll put a source for that in the show notes, just so everyone knows that my uncle isn't lying to you.
I mean, what kind of math? Are we talking about, like, rocket fuel math?
I don't know. I think, like, the calculations, like, we're going to launch
the
angles, and they're going to do
this.
Yeah,
stuff like that.
The trajectories.
I mean, that's pretty easy to duplicate, probably. I don't know how to, but I mean, like... actual mathematicians can probably be like, oh, yeah, that's pretty easy.
Well, we probably have computers now.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we still use that to do launches currently.
Think about the fact that we're just rocketing. We're hurtling through space. And yet we know enough math to be able to take something else and shoot it at something else that's going thousands and tens of thousands of miles per hour while we're going tens of thousands of miles per hour and just get that point just right. It's the craziest thing I've ever heard. Space travel is so insane. It's easy if you think about everything as being in one place, right? Like, this is where the Earth is, this is where Mars is, and imagining that they themselves aren't moving. But when you have, like, all these and then there's, like, other things they have to, yeah, you can't hit another planet while you're trying to get to that planet. It's crazy.
Well said, Sam.
Space.
Yeah, dude.
I am quite space, eloquent, dude. Aren't I?
You are. So yeah, from still myself,
yeah.
I like to, whenever we look at anything, lean towards what's the most probable instead mm-hmm. of making numerous assumptions.
Yeah, that's fair. I, on the other hand, like to make a lot of assumptions.
That's also fair. Dream wildly, my friend.
I have been moving back and forth.
Oscillating,
exactly, for a while now between the idea of UFOs as physical craft and the idea of UFOs as I guess, super physical craft, ultra physical, something that...
Trans-dimensional?
Trans-dimensional,
gosh.
In a way.
Oh,
not
man.
Always, though. But, and this is something that seems to happen when you look at, if you look at somebody who's been studying UFOs, and it's not with everybody for sure, but some of the people that I really respect, they start out thinking, okay, there's nothing here. And then they move to, there's something here. And then they move to, okay, these are aliens. And then from aliens, a lot of people stop there as if that's the last thing that can ever be thought. But in reality, there's so much more. And people go and move forward. You know, Jacques Vallée is a good example. Bud Hopkins is a good example. Even as we'll talk about next episode, J. Allen Hynek is a good example of how you can stop at physical beings and physical craft, or you can move further. And that's where I think we are. But then you juxtapose that with, like, these videos from the Air Force that came out. If it's something...
That looks pretty physical.
Yeah, exactly. this idea that there are materials that have been recovered from crashes by Robert Bigelow, which again was stated in that article.
It's very physical.
Physical.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense at all. So
same thing about ghosts.
Same thing about ghosts. But then you get
they're physical and they're not.
They're
energy, but yet they're not.
Episode alone, we have two or three different accounts of craft that can obviously outmaneuver a jet airplane or a freaking police car.
But for some reason is tethered to it somehow.
Yeah, they play with it. They play with it. And that freaks me out more than anything else.
See, if it wasn't for multiple people from different, like, perspectives seeing it as well, mm-hmm. I would have assumed it was some sort of
anomaly, like with the windshield.
That caused it, because it does stay essentially in one position.
Exactly.
No matter what speeds you're going at.
Exactly.
Which is crazy.
But it is.
Darn it,
multiple
Floyd.
People. Floyd. The UFO's name is Floyd. I love that so much.
We have, but there's multiple instances where we have Floyds.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so weird.
We're going to call all,
the
not
Floyds.
All UFO Floyds, but ones like that.
We're
going to have.
Particular thing, yeah.
Well, I don't know if we have a Floyd next week. No, not yet. We may end up. But anyway, okay, we're getting ahead of ourselves. We'll probably have a nice big longer discussion next week, but
can't wait.
Can't you?
You
seem like you can.
Absolutely.
We want to go ahead. So, we got two new patrons this week.
Woo!
So, we want to thank Betsy Pittman.
Yeah, Betsy.
And we want to thank Ricardo Chavez.
Ricardo.
And Ricardo has a great, I can't even remember his Twitter handle, but he has a great Twitter.
Is it just wonderful?
It's really good.
Is it as good as Mighty Moit?
It's, well, not the handle, right?
Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, his handle is fine, I'm sure. But he follows me on Twitter and Instagram, and I think I follow him back on at least one of those. And it's pretty good. So he's a pretty cool guy.
Yeah.
He's been a vocal supporter of the show for a long time. So thank you, Ricardo. And thank you, Betsy. But if you are interested in learning how to support your favorite show, you can go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast. You can learn how to support us on the $1, $3, or $5 level every month. You can get access to the show longer and quicker than others. You can get periodical bonus episodes and things like that. So again, that's Not Alone Podcast. Or no, it's not. That's, damn it. That's patreon.com/notalonepodcast. Now, all of the... notes, all of the, well, not all the notes. I am thinking, though, once it's over, because like I said, we've got 18,000 words. I've got 31 pages of notes between last week and this week's episode so far. I'm thinking that once we finish next week's episodes, I may put the notes up as a PDF for anybody who wants them with like a big long list of sources. If you're interested in that, let me know. But all of the
time to go through and proofread it.
Yeah. All of the show notes for this week's episode can be found at notalonepodcast.com/UFO2. That's UFO and then the number 2. Yeah, head on over there.
You should have just done it 200-2. UFO-2.
You're right. You're right. So head on over there, and that's where all of that's going to be. And then we also want to thank – we got, I think, one or two new reviews.
Oh, man.
Let me see. You're so excited.
I love reviews.
I do like reviews as well.
Good feedback.
They're nice. It
just makes me happy. Let us know how we're doing.
Okay. We've got one new review. It's from Creighton77. And Creighton says, incredible job. Don't change a thing. You guys are doing just great. Thanks for being entertaining, informative, and all around amazing.
Thank you, Creighton.
You're fantastic.
Oh, jinx.
Yeah. Beyond that, you can go to the website, find all our blog posts there. You can follow me on Twitter. My only Twitter is the Not Alone Podcast Twitter, which is at Not Alone Pod. So be aware, if you're going to follow me there, you're going to get show news and updates and stuff like that. You're also going to get my personal opinions about things. So keep that in mind. And then Jason, you are
Mighty Moit.
Mighty Moit. And Jason, have you made any more tweets since last week?
I got very scared.
Why?
Twitter is still just like a mass of information thrown at me all at once. And it's a lot. Twitter overwhelms me a bit.
So far, Jason has 3 tweets.
Okay, you didn't have to look that up.
The first one is, I made this to follow Wendy's. The second, which was on Christmas, was, Merry Christmas, y'all. Hope you were visited by our favorite red suit wearing cryptid, which is good. I enjoy that. And his third one is, it's a retweet. It's a retweet from one of, and let's mention this person, Mitzi Ray. She has made us 2 or 3 different things of fan art now, and one of them was retweeted by Jason, and it's fantastic. And Jason, this looks like you.
Yeah, it's kind of creepy.
It looks a lot like you, and the me looks a lot like me, but here's the thing. Jason, because he's Jason, he's just surrounded by, like, lines and shiny and cool because Jason's boring. I'm surrounded by ghosts and UFOs and a Bigfoot track, and I think Nessie in the background, so... Mitzi, thank you for the fan art. There is literally nothing that makes me more excited than that. It makes me so happy.
Very great. So really, I have 2 tweets.
Yes, that's
in
true.
Reality,
and then he's replied, I think, tweets. To a few as well. But anyway, go to Mighty Moit to see Jason.
You might get me.
We're on Instagram at Not Alone Pod. We're on Facebook at Not Alone Podcast. We have a Facebook group. Remember. We are not alone, a community for the strange.
Hey, you got it all right? This time.
We'll have a link to that as well. Just come on in, sit right down right now. The hot topic seems to be mattress firm and the fact that there are dozens of mattress firms within square miles of each other and why and what are they doing.
Yeah, dude, money laundering. I'm telling you.
Seriously.
That's what it has to be. You stuff money in mattresses.
Right? That is way literal.
Exactly, man.
I like it.
So I guess that's the time of the podcast where we figure out who did it last week.
Who did it last week?
I'm pretty sure
I
it was
did it
you.
Last week. Yeah. I remember. I'm going to keep remembering forever.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Go ahead.
So remember, whether you're investigating loose ends of things flying in the sky or you're exposing it to the public, we are
not alone.